here today with an interview with Peter Temin. He is an MIT economist. He wrote a book titled The Vanishing Middle Class. And I recently came across this in an article in the Atlantic, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but it really strikes on a number of topics that I think are relevant given kind of the economic dynamics of today. So, Peter, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you.
Awesome. So, tell us a little bit about your background. How long have you been at? How long have you been working in the field of economics?
For about half a century.
So you've seen a lot. So what's the essence of your argument within the vanishing middle class? I mean, I think everybody that's not in the 1% feels squeezed. So how would you describe what's happened?
Yes, well, I described that the distribution of income began to be more diverse in the 1970s. Shortly after I started teaching at MIT, and it was continues today and is getting worse at that time. And for those people who are college educated, roughly 20% of the population, they do well, and so they go along with the very rich people who are currently running our government because their incomes are rising. But the 80%, whom I refer to as the low-wage sector, are being squeezed, as you say. And I guess the operative part of my book is that the very rich people who are running the country at the moment don't care at all about the members of the low-wage sector, that is to say, over three-quarters of the population.
I would completely agree with that. I mean, there's a detached... when I was growing up, I always felt like you were always told that, hey, if you work hard, if you do good, then you'll be rewarded. But the reality is, you know, that really hasn't proved to be the case. There's an amorality to the economy.
Yes, and so as you were told, you can do that, but it's really only for the subset of the population who are already in the upper class. And going to college, of course, is of course a very difficult thing for people whose families don't have money and resources to send them to school and keep them in school and even get them through college.
So how do we reverse that situation given what's developed?
Well, it's very hard to reverse the inequality of income because, of course, the rich also keep a lot of their resources in tax-exempt countries outside the United States. And so our capacity to tax them is limited. But the real thing is that in the modern economy, with the technical changes that are taking place and the competition from less developed countries, we need to educate people. And so what the country and states and localities should be doing is try to strengthen education, public education. And this involves, first of all, and most importantly, early education. Because when you're very poor and you're struggling to put food on the table and you hold two or three jobs, you don't spend much time in bookstores or reading to your children. And so the divergence of incomes and appetite for education starts early. And so getting kids into an early education program, as the mayor of New York has been trying to do in recent years, is a really very good way to start.
Oh, that's awesome. It actually, I saw today that Bernie Sanders announced a bill to wipe out student loan debt. Obviously, debt overall is a huge hangover for the economy, and students starting out are just basically shackled.
Yes, Elizabeth Warren has a plan to do that also, and that would help more people get education, because these are people who tried to get an education. Sometimes it was good, but sometimes, especially for those who went to for-profit universities, they didn't get the skills that they were promised. But in any case, without debt, they then would have more time to invest in their children. Maybe even enough time to buy a house and be able to send their kids to a decent school in one of the suburbs around here.
What, you know, one of the things that I've seen a lot of is a lot of people have gotten higher degrees, higher levels of education, masters, PhDs even, and there have been, even they fall within that 80% of, you know, the underpaid, you know, people who have, you know, literally master's degrees or PhDs living on food stamps and still working multiple jobs.
Yes, that's very sad because, yes, it's been getting harder over time, even with a education, and getting a college education is a necessary thing, but it's not sufficient.
Yeah.
And so what you need to have is either some ingenuity in selling things or in inventing things, or getting a job that you can get. But a lot of people in the situation that you're describing are members of what we call the gig economy, after a musician who plays a gig and then travels on to the next state or next city. And these jobs don't pay very well, and none of them have health care or educational support or any aids to for people to get ahead. And so while a gig economy seems very attractive as an initial thing to do when you get out of college, the young people in it, if they can get a spare moment, would be to try to think of a longer run plan to try to get out of the gig economy and into a more long run, more stable job.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because the other dynamic I think you've seen, especially since, you know, the Great Recession, is that a lot of corporations have literally turned a lot of their workforce into gig employees, you know, really without their, you know, input, in order to get rid of benefit packages for people.
That's right, exactly. That's what a lot of companies have been doing, and our government is supporting that motion.
Yeah.
By putting in regulations from the Labor Department that Uber drivers, for example, are contractors rather than employees. That is to say, not subject to needing to have benefits and any security for that, and that has been done in many, many corporations. So that, yes, they are making it harder and harder, and that's the point that I was making, is that they really don't care what happens.
Yeah.
And if they continue along this line, and we end up with a generation that really can't provide the economy. But the economy is going to turn into a character, or going to look more like a developing economy than like the economy looked after the Second World War. That is to say, without a middle class, the economy is going to be more volatile, the politics are going to be more volatile, and there is going to be a certain amount of turmoil in the society, which, of course, is going to make it even harder for what I call the low-wage sector.
Yeah, I mean, in the higher-wage sector obviously promotes a certain philosophy of economy. The problem is that, you know, for generations, I've heard the argument that, you know, the consumer is the engine of the economy, that if the consumer is healthy, then the economy is going to do well because, you know, money velocity accelerates, you have more jobs, you have more mobility. But, you know, in this kind of all these things that we've talked about, you're really crippling the consumer over the long term in the future.
Yes, and that will affect the whole economy.
Yeah.
And so it won't be able to support these poorer people, and it will be more troublesome. It's also more troublesome for businesses because, as you say correctly, the economy, the production of the economy is mostly for consumption. And if there are people who are unable to consume a lot of these products, then the economy won't be very robust. And so increasingly, as we turn to favoring the businesses that are there, and the businesses invest in artificial intelligence, the problems of caring for the workforce and then having consumers who will then buy the product becomes very, very difficult.
Well, we've already seen the impact of AI starting to play out in jobs. I mean, last year, you know, the banking sector had, you know, obviously a very healthy year, did very well and made tons of money. But, you know, from, you know, what I recall of 2018, pretty much every large bank laid off over 10,000 people. And those jobs went to AI.
Yes. Well, that's one of the very early studies of artificial intelligence. Went into the back room of banks and looked about check clearing. And so this is a very simple form of AI, that the machine would look at the check and verify the signature and go on to record the number and put it into a form to send back to the depositor. So that's an example of what's happening. And this is very dangerous for the whole American economy. And that's why I'm saying, if you want to think about what we're going to do, I think you may even want to think that we're eventually, or put it this way, that our trajectory at the moment is leading us to become a country like Argentina. And if any of you are as old as I am, you can remember that right after the Second World War, they were one of the 10 richest countries in the world.
I didn't know that.
They're very far from that now.
Yeah.
And that was a result of having paralyzed politics so that they couldn't keep a stable government. And so the government kind of lurched from crisis to crisis. And that may be what's there too in a crisis. Some of the crises are financial crises, some of them are balance of payments crises, and so on there. So that Greg Mankiw, a conservative who economist at Harvard, just ran a column in the New York Times last Sunday, I guess that's yesterday, in which he said, oh, we have to play down the debt. Well, of course, the debt that we have was massively increased by the tax cut of 2017,
yeah,
which cut taxes for the very rich. And so he's saying what we need to do is to reduce services. Those are the services that help the low-wage sector, and perhaps raise taxes, by which he means taxing those same people. So the economists seem to be blissfully oblivious to what's going on around them and the long-run future that this has. Now, I can talk about global warming and why isn't everybody worried about that. Well, global warming is real, but it's coming very slowly because the effects of that get involved on, let's say, a decadal business rather than in a year for that. But this transformation of the economy seems to be occurring rather rapidly, particularly under the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless that speed of change is reduced, mm-hmm, and even in some future world reversed, we're going to find ourselves in deep economic trouble.
Yeah, I actually would somewhat disagree with you about the pace of climate change having an economic impact. And I've thought about this a lot. I think I'm wondering if over the past decade, where we've seen temperatures rising, especially around the world, that that doesn't have an impact on growth and behavior within the economy, and that being one of the reasons for this kind of perpetual slowness to economic growth that seems to stump the federal
bank. Because since the current administration doesn't care what's happening to a lot of people, it doesn't help them. So,
yeah,
you know, the various aid passages, bills have not been able to get through Congress for that. And there is surprisingly little planning for this. So if you're,
yeah,
very rich, you can always go out on your yacht and be fine. But if you're living in a seaside town, the ocean is rising.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a problem. And there are things that you can do in advance to minimize the damage. People in the interior of the country thought that they were fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they weren't near the coast, but it turned out that rainfall is a good substitute for rising,
exactly,
oceans.
Yeah.
And so they're in very deep trouble, and particularly the farmers, because it turns out that if your field is flooded, you can't plant the crop.
Yeah.
So you're right that some of this is taking effect now for that, but it's been going on longer. And in fact, something I've read said that the real pace of global warming began around the 1970s,
yeah,
about a half century ago, just like the growth of inequality. I haven't seen a link between the two of those, but it is a kind of curious coincidence.
Funnily enough, I actually did an interview with an economist from Texas, Kerry something. I can't remember his last name, but I'll have to get it for you. But he actually is building a model that actually looks at this connection between income growth and the idea is to build the model out to include energy and climate change. He's in the middle of building that model, but he's already pieced together several pieces of it, and it is really interesting. And it does, like you said, start in the 70s. So that correlation. So when you look at, like, obviously one of the solutions is to have more astute politicians in office that can actually care about, you know, the 80% of the population that is being spat upon. But, like, what else can be done from an effectual standpoint to kind of improve business behavior to make it more beneficial to the whole instead of just a few?
Well, business is very responsible to the context in which it operates. So, in the context of great income diversity, the context it deals with is the prosperous can buy their things. So I get an ad from Apple saying buy a new iPhone for that. If you want the firms to think about other people, you need to have a context in which they work. And that usually is in the context of regulation. But regulation is a government function because it will affect everyone. And so at the moment, the government is just representing these very rich people, so it doesn't do that. But yes, that's what people who want to change this should fight for, is having more people considered for this. And to go back to your banks, you know, Elizabeth Warren started this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was to protect consumers from lenders. And the point is that if lenders are left to do whatever they want to do, they will gouge every penny out of their creditors after the people that they've loaned money to. And so that bureau was for the government to say, you know, you can lend to people, but you have to lend in certain ways and give people information for them to know whether to get a loan or not to get a loan. And that has been gutted by the current administration. So that would be perhaps a place to start.
What, going back to education, when you look at, like, the types of education that people are getting and what's required in the economy going forward, and you mentioned, you know, kind of being more inventive, more entrepreneurial, do you think that it's necessary for people to have more of a liberal arts kind of background, something that kind of fosters that kind of creativity of bringing together different modes of thinking?
Yes, I think that's very important. I think the current emphasis on the so-called STEM subjects, just those technical skills that would be useful in getting your first job, is overdone. Yes, you do need to know something about these subjects, but you also need a liberal education to know a little history, to know a little about people in other places, to read what people have written about other times, so that you can get out of the immediate problem here and think about the context in which you are currently living. So I think a liberal education is very important.
Yeah.
And it is very, very sad that a lot of universities are abolishing or decreasing history departments.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-blowing because, in a sense, if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it, right? So
exactly.
I mean, more than anything, it's a way to learn how to think. And you would think that universities would want people that knew how to think.
Yes, I agree with you totally.
Where do you think we go from here? I mean, is it just a matter of waiting for politicians to get their act together, or what do we do?
Well, I think you don't just sit back and wait. I think you want to be active. You can be active personally by helping some kids, maybe kids, your own grandkids or your kids or something, to understand, to read to them, to help them with books, to talk with them, whatever you can do, to do that on a personal level. And on a government level, run for local city government, run for school school committee. Try to intervene in the educational system to get a good educational system.
Now, that's valuable advice. I mean, people can do so much individually, reaching out to people in their own circle. If everybody does that, I mean, obviously it would have a huge impact.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes. So it's always good to remember that you can think. I'll transfer this into economics jargon. You can think about this macroeconomically, or you can think of it microeconomically.
Yeah.
And the micro things that you do, they have little effect on the whole society. But if you can help a few members of your family or a few kids of the neighborhood or some kids in your local school, you can feel good about this, and you may have helped those individuals.
Awesome. You know, I want to encourage everybody to check out your book. It's called The Vanishing Middle Class, Prejudice and Power in a Dual Economy. And again,
yes. Peter,
thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Right. Thank you. The book's out in paperback now.
Awesome. Awesome.
Good.
Thanks again. And, you know, I look forward to connecting in the future again. Take care, bud.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.